head the Manhattan Clan in only a few short months. Last year, I became her second-in-command. Then, some months ago, I discovered that she had been killing humans, killing them for sport, and drinking their blood, breaking the law. It happens sometimes. Vampires go rogue, and there is nothing that can be done to stop them. But for it to happen to the head of a clan, they are supposed to be better than that. He stood still, his dark eyes inward-looking, lost in his memories. We are not like the wolves, those savages. We do not kill one leader to find another. For a vampire to raise a hand against another vampire is the worst of crimes, even if that vampire has broken the law. And Camille has many allies, many followers. I could not risk ending her. Instead, I went to her and told her she had to leave us, to get out, or I would go to the Clave. I didn't want to do that, of course, because I knew that if it were discovered, it would bring wrath down on the entire clan. We would be distrusted, investigated. We would be shamed and humiliated in front of other clans. Maris made an impatient noise. There are more important things than loss of face. When you are a vampire, it can mean the difference between life and death. Raphael's voice dropped. I gambled that she would believe I would do it. And she did. She agreed to go. I sent her away. But it left behind a conundrum. I could not take her place, for she had not abdicated it. I could not explain her departure without revealing what she had done. I had to pose it as a long absence, a need to travel. Wanderlust is not unheard of in our kind. It comes upon us now and then. When you can live forever, staying in one place can come to seem a dull prison after many, many years. And how long did you think you could keep up the charade? Luke inquired.
As long as I could, said Raphael. Until now, it seems.
He looked away from them, toward the window and the sparkling night outside. Luke leaned back against one of the bookshelves. He was vaguely amused to notice that he seemed to be in the shapeshifter section, lined with volumes on the topics of werewolves, naga, kitsunes, and selkies.
You might be interested to know she has been telling much the same story about you, he said, neglecting to mention whom she had been telling it to.
I thought she had left the city.
Perhaps she did, but she has returned, said Maris. And she is no longer satisfied only with human blood, it seems.
I do not know what I can tell you, said Raphael. I was trying to protect my clan. If the law must punish me, then I will accept punishment.
We aren't interested in punishing you, Raphael, said Luke. Not unless you refuse to cooperate. Raphael turned back to them, his dark eyes burning.
Cooperate with what?
We would like to capture Camille. Alive, said Maris. We want to question her. We need to know why she has been killing shadow hunters, and these shadow hunters in particular.
If you sincerely hope to accomplish this, I hope you've a very clever plan.
There was a mixture of amusement and scorn in Raphael's voice. Camille is cunning even for our kind, and we are very cunning indeed.
I have a plan, said Luke. It involves the Daylighter, Simon Lewis. Raphael made a face.
I dislike him, he said.
I would rather not be a part of a plan that relies upon his involvement.
Well, said Luke,
isn't that too bad for you?
Stupid, Clary thought. Stupid not to bring an umbrella. The faint drizzle that her mother had told her was coming that morning had turned into nearly full-blown rain by the time she reached the Alto Bar on Lorimer Street. She pushed past the knot of people smoking out on the sidewalk and ducked gratefully into the dry warmth of the bar inside. Millennium Lent was already on stage, the guys wailing away on their instruments, and Kyle at the front growling sexily into a microphone. Clary felt a moment of satisfaction. It was largely down to her influence that they'd hired Kyle at all, and he was clearly doing them proud. She glanced around the room, hoping to see either Maya or Isabel. She knew it wouldn't be both of them, since Simon carefully invited them only to alternating gigs. Her gaze fell on a slender figure with black hair, and she moved toward that table, only to stop midway. It wasn't Isabel at all, but a much older woman, her face made up with dark outlined eyes. She was wearing a power suit and reading a newspaper, apparently oblivious to the music.
"Clary, over here!"
Clary turned and saw the actual Isabel, seated at a table close to the stage. She wore a dress that shone like a silver beacon. Clary navigated toward it and flung herself down in the seat opposite Izzy.
"Got caught in the rain, I see," Isabel observed.
Clary pushed her damp hair back from her face with a rueful smile.
"You bet against Mother Nature, you lose."
Isabel raised her dark eyebrows.
"I thought you weren't coming tonight. Simon said you had some wedding blah blah to deal with."
Isabel was not impressed with weddings or any of the trappings of romantic love, as far as Clary could tell.
"My mom wasn't feeling well," Clary said. "She decided to reschedule."
This was true, up to a point. When they'd come home from the hospital, Jocelyn had gone into her room and shut the door. Clary, feeling helpless and frustrated, had heard her crying softly through the door, but her mom had refused to let her in or to talk about it. Eventually, Luke had come home, and Clary had gratefully left the care of her mother to him and headed out to kick around the city before going to see Simon's band. She always tried to come to his gigs if she could, and besides, talking to him would make her feel better.
"Huh?"
Isabel didn't inquire further. Sometimes her almost total lack of interest in other people's problems was something of a relief.
"Well, I'm sure Simon will be glad you came."
Clary glanced toward the stage. "How's the show been so far?"
"Fine," Isabel chewed thoughtfully on her straw.
"That new lead singer they have is hot. Is he single? I'd like to ride him around town like a bad, bad pony."
"Isabel!"
"What?" Isabel glanced over at her and shrugged.
"Oh, whatever. Simon and I aren't exclusive. I told you that."
Admittedly, Clary thought, Simon didn't have a leg to stand on in this particular situation, but he was still her friend. She was about to say something in his defense when she glanced toward the stage again, and something caught her eye. A familiar figure emerging from the stage door. She would have recognized him anywhere, at any time, no matter how dark the room or how unexpected the sight of him. Chase. He was dressed like a mundane, jeans, a tight black t-shirt that showed the movement of his slim muscles in his shoulders and back. His hair gleamed under the stage lights. Covert gazes watched him as he moved toward the wall and leaned against it, looking intently toward the front of the room. Clary felt her heart begin to pound. It felt like it had been forever since she'd last seen him, though she knew it had been only about a day. And yet, already, watching him seemed like watching someone distant, a stranger. What was he even doing here? He didn't like Simon. He'd never come to a single one of the band's performances before.
"Clary!"
Isabel sounded accusing. Clary turned to see that she'd accidentally upset Isabel's glass, and water was dripping off the other girl's lovely silver dress. Isabel, grabbing a napkin, looked at her darkly.
"Just talk to him," she said. "I know you want to."
"I'm sorry," Clary said.
Isabel made a shooing gesture in her direction.
"Go." Clary got up, smoothing down her dress. If she'd known Jace was going to be here, she would have worn something other than red tights, boots, and a vintage hot pink Betsy Johnson dress of hers she'd found hanging in Luke's spare closet. Once, she'd thought the flower-shaped green buttons that ran all the way up the front were funky and cool. But now, she just felt less put together and sophisticated than Isabel. She pushed her way across the floor,
which was now crowded with people either dancing or standing in place drinking beer and swaying a little to the music. She couldn't help but remember the first time she'd ever seen Jace. It had been in a club, and she'd watched him across the floor, watched his bright hair and the arrogant set of his shoulders. She thought he was beautiful, but not in any way that applied to her. He wasn't the sort of boy you could have dated, she thought. He existed apart from that world. He didn't notice her now until she was nearly standing in front of him. Up close, she could see how tired he looked, as if he hadn't slept in days. His face was tight with exhaustion, the bones sharp-looking under the skin. He was leaning against the wall, his fingers hooked in the loops of his belt, his pale gold eyes watchful. "Jace," she said. He started and turned to look at her. For a moment, his eyes lit, the way they always did when he saw her, and she felt a wild hope rise in her chest. Almost instantly, the light went out of them, and the remaining color drained out of his face. "I thought Simon said you weren't coming." A wave of nausea passed over her, and she put her hand out to steady herself against the wall. "So you only came because you thought I wouldn't be here." He shook his head. Were you ever planning on talking to me again?" Clary felt her voice rise and forced it back down with a vicious effort. Her hands were now tight at her sides, her nails cutting hard into her palms. "If you're going to break it off, the least you could do is tell me, not just stop talking to me and leave me to figure it out on my own." "Why?" Jay said. "Does everyone keep goddamn asking me if I'm going to break up with you? First Simon, and now..." "You talked to Simon about us?" Clary shook her head. "Why? Why aren't you talking to me?" "Because I can't talk to you," Jay said. "I can't talk to you. I can't be with you. I can't even look at you." Clary sucked her breath in. It felt like breathing battery acid. "What?" He seemed to realize what he had said, and lapsed into an appalled silence. For a moment, they simply looked at each other. Then Clary turned and darted back through the crowd, pushing her way past flailing elbows and knots of chatting people, blind to everything but getting to the door as quickly as she could.
"And now," Eric yelled into his microphone, "we're going to sing a new song, one we just wrote. This one's for my girlfriend. We've been going out for 3 weeks, and damn, love is true. We're gonna be together forever, baby. This one's called Bang You Like a Drum."
There was laughter and applause from the audience as the music started up, for Simon wasn't sure if Eric realized they thought he was joking, which he wasn't. Eric was always in love with whatever girl he just started dating, and he always wrote an inappropriate song about it. Normally, Simon wouldn't have cared, but he'd really hoped they were going to get off the stage after the previous song. He felt worse than ever, dizzy, sticky, and sick with sweat, his mouth tasting metallic like old blood. The music crashed around him, sounding like nails being pounded into his eardrums. His fingers slipped and slid on the strings as he played, and he saw Kirk look over at him quizzically. He tried to force himself to focus, to concentrate, but it was like trying to start a car with a dead battery. There was an empty grinding noise in his head, but no spark. He stared out into the bar looking, he wasn't even quite sure why, for Isabel, but he could see only a sea of white faces turned toward him, and he remembered his first night in the Dumont Hotel, and the faces of the vampires turned toward him, like white paper flowers unfolding against the dark emptiness. A surge of gripping, painful nausea seized him. He staggered back, his hands falling away from the guitar. The ground under his feet felt as if it were moving. The other members of the band, caught up in the music, didn't seem to notice. Simon tore the strap of the guitar off his shoulder and pushed past Matt to the curtain at the back of the stage, ducking through it just in time to fall to his knees and retch. Nothing came up. His stomach felt as hollow as a well. He stood up and leaned against the wall, pressing his icy hands against his face. It had been weeks since he felt either cold or hot, but now he felt feverish and scared. What was happening to him? He remembered Jace saying, "You're a vampire, Blood isn't like food for you. Blood is blood. Could all this be because he hadn't eaten? But he didn't feel hungry, or even thirsty, really. He felt as sick as if he were dying. Maybe he'd been poisoned. Maybe the mark of Cain didn't protect against something like that. He moved slowly toward the fire door that would take him out onto the street in the back of the club. Maybe the cold air outside would clear his head. Maybe all this was just exhaustion and nerves.
Simon?
A little voice, like a bird's chirp. He looked down with dread and saw that Maureen was standing at his elbow. She looked even tinier close up. Little bird-like bones and a lot of very pale blonde hair, which cascaded down her shoulders from beneath a knitted pink cap. She wore rainbow stripe arm warmers and a short-sleeved white t-shirt with a screen print of strawberry shortcake on it. Simon groaned inwardly.
"This really isn't a good time, Mo," he said.
"I just want to take a picture of you on my camera phone," she said, pushing her hair back behind her ears nervously.
"So I can show my friends, okay?"
"Fine." His head was pounding. This was ridiculous. It wasn't like he was overwhelmed with fans. Maureen was literally the band's only fan that he knew about, and was Eric's little cousin's friend to boot. He supposed he couldn't really afford to alienate her.
"Go ahead, take it."
She raised her phone and clicked and frowned.
"Now one with you and me."
She sidled up to him quickly, pressing herself against his side. He could smell strawberry lip gloss on her, and under that, the smell of salt sweat and saltier human blood. She looked up at him, holding the phone up and out with her free hand and grinned. She had a gap between her two front teeth and a blue vein in her throat. It pulsed as she drew a breath.
"Smile,"
she said. Twin jolts of pain went through Simon as his fangs slid free, digging into his lip. He heard Maureen gasp, and then her phone went flying as he caught hold of her and spun her toward him. His canine teeth sank into her throat. Blood exploded into his mouth, the taste of it like nothing else. It was as if he'd been starving for air and now was breathing, inhaling great gasps of cold, clean oxygen, and Maureen struggled and pushed at him, but he barely noticed. He didn't even notice when she went limp, her dead weight dragging him to the floor so that he was lying on top of her, his hands gripping her shoulders, clenching and unclenching as he drank.
"You have never fed on someone purely human, have you?"
Camilla said.
"You will.
And when you do, you will never forget it."
Chapter 9. From Fire Unto Fire. Clary reached the door and burst out into the rain-drenched evening air. It was coming down in sheets now, and she was instantly soaked. Choking on rainwater and tears, she darted past Eric's familiar-looking yellow van, rain sheeting off its roof into the gutter, and was about to race across the street against the light when a hand caught her arm and spun her around. It was Jace. He was as soaked as she was, the rain sticking his fair hair to his head and plastering his shirt to his body like black paint.
"Clary, didn't you hear me calling you?"
"Let go of me." Her voice shook.
"No, not until you talk to me."
He looked around, up and down the street, which was deserted, the rain exploding off the black pavement like fast-blooming flowers.
"Come on."
Still holding her by the arm, he half-dragged her around the van and into a narrow alley that bordered the Alto Bar. High windows above them let through the blurred sound of the music that was still being played inside. The alley was brick-walled, clearly a dumping ground for old bits of no longer usable musical equipment. Broken amps and old mics littered the ground, along with shattered beer glasses and cigarette butts. Clary jerked her arm out of Jace's grasp and turned to face him.
"If you're planning to apologize, don't bother."
She pushed her wet, heavy hair back from her face. "I don't want to hear it."
"I was going to tell you that I was trying to help out Simon," he said, rainwater running off his eyelashes and down his cheeks like tears. "I've been at his place for the past, and you couldn't tell me. Couldn't text me a single line letting me know where you were. Oh, wait. You couldn't, because you still have my goddamn phone. Give it to me."
Silently, he reached into his jeans pocket and handed it to her. It looked undamaged. She jammed it into her messenger bag before the rain could ruin it.
Jace watched her as she did it, looking as if she'd hit him in the face, and only made her angrier. What right did he have to be hurt? "I think," he said slowly, "that I thought that the closest thing to being with you was being with Simon, watching out for him. I had some stupid idea that you'd realize I was doing it for you and forgive me." All of Clary's rage rose to the surface, a hot, unstoppable tide. "I don't even know what you think I'm supposed to forgive you for," she shouted. "Am I supposed to forgive you for not loving me anymore? Because if that's what you want, Jace Lightwood, you can go right ahead and..." She took a step back, blindly, and nearly tripped over an abandoned speaker. Her bag slid to the ground as she put her hand out to right herself, but Jace was already there. He moved forward to catch her and kept moving until her back hit the alley wall and his arms were around her and he was kissing her frantically. She knew she ought to push him away. Her mind told her it was the sensible thing to do, but no other part of her cared about what was sensible. Not when Jace was kissing her like he thought he might go to hell for doing it, but it would be worth it. She dug her fingers into his shoulders, into the damp fabric of his t-shirt, feeling the resistance of the muscles underneath, and kissed him back with all the desperation of the past few days, all the not knowing where he was or what he was thinking, all the feeling like a part of her heart had been ripped out of her chest and she could never get enough air. "Tell me," she said between kisses, their wet faces sliding against each other. "Tell me what's wrong." "Oh," she gasped as he drew away from her, only far enough to reach his hands down and put them around her waist. He lifted her up so she stood on top of a broken speaker, making them almost the same height. Then he put his hands on either side of her head and leaned forward, so their bodies almost touched, but not quite. It was nerve-wracking. She could feel the feverish heat that came off him. Her hands were still on his shoulders, but it wasn't enough. She wanted him wrapped around her, holding her tight. "Why?" she breathed. "Can't you talk to me? Why can't you look at me?" He ducked his head down to look into her face. His eyes, surrounded by lashes darkened with rainwater, were impossibly gold. "Because I love you." She couldn't stand it anymore. She took her hands off his shoulders, hooked her fingers through his belt loops, and pulled him against her. He let her do it with no resistance, his hands flattening against the wall, folding his body against hers until they were pressed together everywhere. Chests, hips, legs, like puzzle pieces. His hands slid down to her waist and he kissed her, long and lingering, making her shudder. She pulled away. "That doesn't make any sense." "Neither does this," he said. "But I don't care. I'm sick of trying to pretend I can live without you. Don't you understand that? Can't you see it's killing me?" She stared at him. She could see he meant what he said, could see it in the eyes she knew as well as her own, in the bruised shadows under those eyes, the pulse pounding in his throat. Her desire for answers battled the more primal part of her brain, and lost. "Kiss me then," she whispered, and he pressed his mouth against hers, their hearts slamming together through the thin layers of wet fabric that divided them. And she was drowning in it. In the sensation of him kissing her, of rain everywhere, running off her eyelashes, of letting his hand slide freely over the wet, crumpled fabric of her dress, made thin and clinging by the rain. It was almost like having his hands on her bare skin, her chest, her hips, her stomach. When he reached the hem of her dress, he gripped her legs, pressing her harder back against the wall while she wrapped them around his waist. He made a noise of surprise, low in his throat, and dug his fingers into the thin fabric of her tights. Not unexpectedly, they ripped, and his wet fingers were suddenly on the bare skin of her legs. Not to be outdone, she slid her hands under the hem of his soaked shirt and let her fingers explore what was underneath. The tight, hot skin over his ribs, the ridges of his abdomen, the scars on his back, the angle of his hip bones above the waistband of his jeans. This was uncharted territory for her, but it seemed to be driving him crazy. He was moaning softly against her mouth, kissing her harder and harder, as if it would never be enough, not quite enough. And a horrific clanging noise exploded in Clary's ears, shattering her out of her dream of kissing and rain. With a gasp, she pushed Jace away hard enough that he let go of her, and she tumbled off the speaker to land unsteadily on her feet, hastily straightening her dress. Her heart was slamming against her ribcage like a battering ram, and she felt dizzy. "Damn it!" Isabel, standing in the mouth of the alley, her wet black hair like a cloak around her shoulders, kicked a trash can out of her way and glowered. "Oh, for goodness sake," she said. "I can't believe you two." "Why? What's wrong with bedrooms and privacy?" Clary looked at Jace. He was utterly drenched, water running off him in sheets, his fair hair plastered to his head, nearly silver in the faint glow of the distant streetlights. Just looking at him made Clary want to touch him again. Isabel or no Isabel. With a longing that was nearly painful. He was staring at Izzy, with the look of someone who had been slapped out of a dream. Bewilderment, anger, dawning realization. "I was just looking for Simon," Isabel said defensively, seeing Jace's expression. "He ran off stage, and I've no idea where he went." The music had stopped, Clary realized, at some point. She hadn't noticed when. "Anyway, he's obviously not here. Go back to what you were doing. What's the point in wasting a perfectly good brick wall when you have someone to throw against it? That's what I always say." And she stalked off, back toward the bar. Clary looked at Jace. At any other time, they would have laughed together at Isabel's moodiness. But there was no humor in his expression, and she knew immediately that whatever they had between them, whatever had blossomed out of his momentary lack of control, it was gone now. She could taste blood in her mouth, and wasn't sure if she had bitten her own lip, or he had. "Jace?" She took a step toward him. "Don't," he said, his voice very rough. "I can't." And then he was gone, running as fast as only he could run. A blur that vanished into the distance before she could even take a breath to call him back.
"Simon!" The angry voice exploded into Simon's ears. He would have released Maureen then, or so he told himself, but he didn't get the chance. Strong hands grabbed him by the arms, hauling him off her. He was dragged to his feet by a white-faced Kyle, still tousled and sweaty from the set they just finished. "What the hell, Simon? What the hell?" "I didn't mean to," Simon gasped. His voice sounded blurry to his own ears. His fangs were still out, and he hadn't learned to talk around the goddamn things yet. Past Kyle, on the floor, he could see Maureen lying in a crumpled heap, horribly still.
"It just happened."
"I told you. I told you." Kyle's voice rose, and he pushed Simon hard. Simon stumbled back, his forehead burning, as an invisible hand seemed to lift Kyle and fling him hard against the wall behind him. He hit it and slid to the ground, landing in a wolf-like crouch on his hands and knees. He staggered to his feet, staring.
"Jesus Christ, Simon."
But Simon had dropped to his knees beside Maureen, his hands on her, frantically feeling at her throat for a pulse. When it fluttered under his fingertips, faint but steady, he nearly wept with relief.
"Get away from her."
Kyle, sounding strained, moved to stand over Simon.
"Just get up and move away."
Simon got up reluctantly and faced Kyle over Maureen's limp form. Light was lancing through the gap in the curtains that led to the stage. He could hear the other band members out there, chattering to one another, starting the teardown. Any minute they'd be coming back here.
"What you just did," Kyle said. "Did you push me? Because I didn't see you move."
"I didn't mean to," Simon said again, wretchedly. It seemed to be all he said these days. Kyle shook his head, his hair flying.
"Get out of here. Go away by the van. I'll deal with her."
He bent down and lifted Maureen into his arms. She looked tiny against the bulk of him, like a doll. He fixed Simon with a glare.
"Go, and I hope you feel really goddamn terrible."
Simon went. He moved to the fire door and shoved it open. No alarm went off. The alarm had been busted for months.
The door swung shut behind him and he leaned up against the back wall of the club as every part of his body began to tremble. The club backed onto a narrow street lined with warehouses. Across the way was a vacant lot, blocked off with a sagging chain-link fence. Ugly scrub grass grew up through the cracks in the pavement. Rain was sheeting down, soaking the garbage that littered the street, floating old beer cans on the runoff-filled gutters. Simon thought it was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen. The whole night seemed to have exploded with prismatic light. The fence was a linked chain of brilliant silver wires, each raindrop a platinum tear.
"I hope you feel really goddamn terrible," Kyle had said.
But this was much worse. He felt fantastic, alive in a way he had never been before. Human blood was clearly somehow the perfect, the ideal food for vampires. Waves of energy were running through him like an electric current. The pain in his head, his stomach, was gone. He could have run 10,000 miles. It was awful.
"Hey! You! Are you all right?"
The voice that spoke was cultured, amused. Simon turned and saw a woman in a long black trench coat, a bright yellow umbrella open over her head. With his brand new prismatic vision, it looked like a glimmering sunflower. The woman herself was beautiful, though everything looked beautiful to him right now, with gleaming black hair and a red lipstick mouth. He dimly recalled seeing her sitting at one of the tables during the band's performance. He nodded, not trusting himself to speak. He must have looked pretty shell-shocked if total strangers were coming out to inquire about his well-being.
"You look like maybe you got banged on the head there," she said, indicating his forehead. "That's a nasty bruise. Are you sure I can't call anyone for you?"
He reached up hastily to move his hair across his forehead, hiding the mark.
"I'm fine. It's nothing."
"Okay, if you say so."
She sounded a little doubtful. She reached into her pocket, pulled out a card, and handed it to him. It had a name on it. Satrina Kendall. Underneath the name was a title, band promoter, in small capitals, and a phone number and address.
"That's me," she said. "I liked what you guys did there. If you're interested in making it a little more big time, give me a call."
And with that, she turned and sashayed away, leaving Simon staring after her. Surely, he thought, there was no way this night could get any more bizarre. Shaking his head, a move that sent water drops flying in all directions, he squelched around the corner to where the van was parked. The door of the bar was open, and people were streaming out. Everything still looked unnaturally bright, Simon thought, but his prismatic vision was beginning to fade slightly. The scene in front of him looked ordinary, the bar emptying out, the side doors open, and the van with its back doors open, already being loaded up with gear by Matt, Kirk, and a variety of their friends. As Simon drew closer, he saw that Isabel was leaning against the side of the van, one leg drawn up, the heel of her boot braced against the van's blistered side. She could have been helping with the teardown, of course. Isabel was stronger than anyone else in the band, with the possible exception of Kyle. But she clearly couldn't be bothered. Simon would hardly have expected anything else. She looked up as he came closer. The rain had slowed, but she had clearly been out in it for some time. Her hair was a heavy, wet curtain down her back.
"Hey there,"
she said, pushing off from the side of the van and coming toward him.
"Where have you been? You just ran off stage."
"Yeah," he said. "I wasn't feeling well, sorry."
"As long as you're better now."
She wrapped her arms around him and smiled up into his face. He felt a wave of relief that he didn't feel any urge to bite her. Then another wave of guilt as he remembered why.
"You haven't seen Jace anywhere, have you?"
he asked. She rolled her eyes.
"I ran across him and Clary making out," she said. "Although they're gone now, home, I hope. Those two epitomize get a room."
"I didn't think Clary was coming,"
Simon said, though it wasn't that odd. He supposed the cake appointment had been cancelled or something. He didn't even have the energy to be annoyed about what a terrible bodyguard Jace had turned out to be. It wasn't as if he ever thought Jace took his personal safety all that seriously. He just hoped Jace and Clary had worked it out, whatever it was.
"Whatever,"
Isabel grinned.
"Since it's just us, do you want to go somewhere and..."
A voice, a very familiar voice, spoke out of the shadows just beyond the reach of the nearest streetlight.
"Simon."
"Oh no, not now, not right now,"
Simon thought. He turned slowly. Isabel's arm was still loosely clasped around his waist, though he knew that wouldn't last much longer, not if the person speaking was who he thought it was.
It was. Maya had moved into the light and was standing looking at him, an expression of disbelief on her face. Her normally curly hair was pasted to her head with rain, and her amber eyes very wide, her jeans and denim jacket soaked. She was clutching a rolled-up piece of paper in her left hand. Simon was vaguely aware that off to the side, the band members had slowed down their movements and were openly gawking. Isabel's arm slid off his waist. "Simon," she said, "what's going on?"
"You told me you were going to be busy," Maya said, looking at Simon. "Then someone shoved this under the station door this morning."
She thrust the rolled-up paper forward. It was instantly recognizable as one of the flyers for the band's performance tonight. Isabel was looking from Simon to Maya, recognition slowly dawning on her face.
"Wait a second," she said. "Are you two dating?"
Maya set her chin. "Are you?"
"Yes,"
Isabel said.
"For quite a few weeks now."
Maya's eyes narrowed.
"Us too. We've been dating since September."
"I can't believe it," Isabel said. She genuinely looked as if she couldn't.
"Simon?"
She turned to him, her hands on her hips.
"Do you have an explanation?"
The band, who had finally shoved all the equipment into the van, the drums packing out the back bench seat and the guitars and basses in the cargo section, were hanging out the back of the car, openly staring. Eric put his hands around his mouth to make a megaphone.
"Ladies, ladies," he intoned. "There is no need to fight. There is enough Simon to go around."
Isabel whipped around and shot a glare at Eric so terrifying that he fell instantly silent. The back doors of the van slammed shut, and it took off down the road.
"Traitors," Simon thought.
Though to be fair, they probably assumed he would catch a ride home in Kyle's car, which was parked around the corner. Assuming he lived long enough.
"I can't believe you, Simon," Maya said.
She was standing there with her hands on her hips as well, in a pose identical to Isabel's.
"What were you thinking? How could you lie like that?"
"I didn't lie," Simon protested. "We never said we were exclusive."
He turned to Isabel.
"Neither did we. And I know you were dating other people."
"Not people you know," Isabel said blisteringly. "Not your friends. How would you feel if you found out I was dating Eric?"
"Stunned, frankly," said Simon. "It really isn't your type."
"That's not the point, Simon."
Maya had moved closer to Isabel, and the two of them faced him down together, an immovable wall of female rage. The bar had finished emptying out, and aside from the three of them, the street was deserted. He wondered about his chances if he made a break for it and decided they weren't good. Werewolves were fast, and Isabel was a trained vampire hunter.
"I'm really sorry," Simon said.
The buzz from the blood he'd drunk was beginning to wear off, thankfully. He felt less dizzy with overwhelming sensation, but more panicked. To make things worse, his mind kept returning to Maureen and what he'd done to her and whether she was all right.
"Please let her be all right. I should have told you guys, it's just, I really like you both and I didn't want to hurt either of your feelings."
The moment it was out of his mouth, he realized how stupid he sounded. Just another jerkish guy making excuses for his jerk behavior. Simon had never thought of himself like that. He was a nice guy, the kind of guy who got overlooked, passed up for the sexy bad boy, the tortured artist type. For the self-involved kind of guy, who would think nothing of dating two girls at once, while maybe not exactly lying about what he was doing, but not telling the truth about it either.
"Well,"
he said, mostly to himself,
"I am a huge asshole."
"That's probably the first true thing you've said since I got here," said Maya.
"Amen,"
said Isabel.
"Though if you ask me, it's too little, too late."
The side door of the bar opened and someone came out. It was Kyle. Simon felt a wave of relief. Kyle looked serious, but not as serious as Simon thought he would look if something awful had happened to Maureen. He started down the steps toward them. The rain was barely a drizzle now. Maya and Isabel had their backs to him. They were glaring at Simon with the laser focus of rage.
"I hope you don't expect either of us to speak to you again," Isabel said. "And I'm going to have to talk with Clary. A very, very serious talk about her choice of friends."
"Kyle!"
Simon said, unable to keep the relief out of his voice as Kyle came into earshot.
"Maureen, is she..."
He had no idea how to ask what he wanted to ask without letting Maya and Isabel know what had happened. But as it turned out, It didn't matter, because he never managed to get the rest of the words out. Maya and Isabel turned. Isabel looked annoyed, and Maya surprised, clearly wondering who Kyle was. As soon as Maya really saw Kyle, her face changed. Her eyes went wide, the blood draining from her face. And Kyle, in his turn, was staring at her with the look of someone who had woken up from a nightmare, only to discover that it is real and continuing. His mouth moved, shaping words, but no sound came out. "Well," Isabel said, looking from one of them to the other, "do you two know each other?" Maya's lips parted. She was still staring at Kyle. Simon had time to think she had never looked at him with anything like that intensity, when she whispered, "Jordan?" and lunged for Kyle, her claws out and sharp, and sank them into his throat. Part 2. For Every Life. Nothing is free. Everything has to be paid for. For every profit in one thing, payment in some other thing. For every life, a death. Even your music, of which we have heard so much, that had to be paid for. Your wife was the payment for your music. Hell is now satisfied. Ted Hughes, The Tiger's Bones. Chapter 10, 232, Riverside Drive. Simon sat in the armchair in Kyle's living room and stared at the frozen image on the TV screen in the corner of the room. It had been paused on the game Kyle had been playing with Jace, and the image was one of a dank-looking underground tunnel with a heap of collapsed bodies on the ground and some very realistic-looking pools of blood. It was disturbing, but Simon didn't have the energy or the inclination to bother to turn it off. The images that had been running through his head all night were worse. The light streaming into the room through the windows had strengthened from watery dawn light to the pale illumination of early morning, but Simon barely noticed. He kept seeing Maureen's limp body on the ground, her blonde hair stained with blood. His own staggering progress out into the night, her blood singing through his veins. And then Maya lunging at Kyle, tearing into him with her claws. Kyle had lain there, not lifting a hand to defend himself. He probably would have let her kill him if Isabel hadn't interfered, pulling Maya bodily off him and rolling her onto the pavement, holding her there until her rage dissolved into tears. Simon had tried to go to her, but Isabel had held him off with a furious glare, her arm around the other girl, her hand up to ward him off. "Get out of here," she said, "and take him with you. I don't know what he did to her, but it must have been pretty bad." And it was. Simon knew that name, Jordan. It had come up before, when he'd asked her how she'd been turned into a werewolf. Her ex-boyfriend had done it, she said. He'd done it with a savage and vicious attack and had run off afterward, leaving her to deal with the aftermath alone. His name had been Jordan. That was why Kyle had only one name next to his door buzzer, because it was his last name. His full name must have been Jordan Kyle, Simon realized. He'd been stupid, unbelievably stupid, not to have figured it out before. Not that he needed another reason to hate himself right now. Kyle, or rather Jordan, was a werewolf. He healed fast. By the time Simon had hauled him none too gently to his feet and had led him back over to his car, the deep slashes in his throat, under the torn rags of his shirt, had healed to crusted over scars. Simon had taken his keys from him and driven them back to Manhattan mostly in silence. Jordan, sitting almost motionless in the passenger seat, staring down at his bloody hands. "Maureen's fine," he said finally as they drove over the Williamsburg Bridge. "It looked worse than it was. You're not that good at feeding off humans yet, so she hadn't lost too much blood. I put her in a cab. She doesn't remember anything. She thinks she fainted in front of you, and she's really embarrassed." Simon knew he ought to thank Jordan, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. "You're Jordan," he said. "Maya's old boyfriend. The one who turned her into a werewolf." They were on Kenmare now. Simon turned north, heading up the Bowery with his flop houses and lighting stores. "Yeah," Jordan said at last. "Kyle's my last name. I started to go by it when I joined the Praetor. She would have killed you if Isabel would have let her." "She has the perfect right to kill me if she wants to," said Jordan, and fell silent. He didn't say anything else as Simon found parking, and they trudged up the stairs to the apartment. He'd gone into his room without even taking off his bloody jacket and slammed the door. Simon had packed his things into his backpack and had been about to leave the apartment when he'd hesitated. He wasn't sure why, even now. But instead of leaving, he'd dropped his bag by the door and come back to sit in this chair where he'd stayed all night. He wished he could call Clary, but it was too early in the morning. And besides, Isabel had said she and Jace had gone off together, and the thought of interrupting some special moment of theirs wasn't appealing. He wondered how his mother was. If she could have seen him last night with Maureen, she would have thought he was every bit the monster she'd accused him of being. Maybe he was. He looked up as Jordan's door cracked open, and Jordan emerged. He was barefoot, still in the same jeans and shirt he'd been wearing yesterday. The scars on his throat faded to red lines. He looked at Simon. His hazel eyes, normally so bright and cheerful, were darkly shadowed.
"Thought you'd leave,"
he said.
"I was going to," Simon said. "But then I figured I ought to give you the chance to explain."
"There's nothing to explain." Jordan shuffled into the kitchen and dug around in a drawer until he produced a coffee filter.
"Whatever Maya said about me, I'm sure it was true." "She said you hit her," Simon said.
Jordan, in the kitchen, went very still. He looked down at the filter, as if he were no longer quite sure what it was for.
"She said you guys went out for months and everything was great," Simon went on. "Then you turned violent and jealous. When she called you on it, you hit her. She broke up with you. And when she was walking home one night, something attacked her and nearly killed her. And you took off out of town. No apology, no explanation."
Jordan set the filter down on the counter. "How did she get here? How did she find Luke Garraway's pack?" Simon shook his head.
"She hopped a train to New York and tracked him down. She's a survivor, Maya. She didn't let what you did to her wreck her. A lot of people would have."
"Is that why you stayed?" asked Jordan.
"To tell me I'm a bastard? Because I already know that." "I stayed," Simon said, "because of what I did last night. If I'd found out about you yesterday, I would have left. But after what I did to Maureen," he chewed his lip, "I thought I had control over what happened to me, and I didn't. And I hurt someone who didn't deserve it, so that's why I'm staying."
"Because if I'm not a monster, then you're not a monster."
"'Cause I want to know how to go on now. And maybe you can tell me."
Simon leaned forward.
"Because you've been a good guy to me since I met you. I've never seen you be mean or get angry. And then I thought about the Wolf Guard and how you said you joined it because you'd done bad things. And I thought Maya was maybe the bad thing you'd done that you were trying to make up for."
"I was," said Jordan. "She is."
Clary sat at her desk in Luke's small spare room, the scrap of cloth she'd taken from the Beth Israel morgue spread out in front of her. She'd weighted it down on either side with pencils and was hovering over it, steely in hand, trying to remember the rune that had come to her in the hospital. It was hard to concentrate. She kept thinking about Jace, about last night, where he might have gone, why he was so unhappy. She hadn't realized until she had seen him that he was as miserable as she was, and it tore at her heart. She wanted to call him, but had held herself back from doing so several times since she'd gotten home. If he was going to tell her what the problem was, he'd have to do it without being asked. She knew him well enough to know that. She closed her eyes and tried to force herself to picture the rune. It wasn't one she'd invented, she was pretty sure. It was one that actually existed, though she wasn't sure she'd seen it in the Great Book. Its shape spoke to her less of translation than of revelation, of showing the shape of something hidden below ground, blowing the dust away from it slowly to read the inscription beneath. The steely twitched in her fingers, and she opened her eyes to find, to her surprise, that she'd managed to trace a small pattern on the edge of the fabric. It looked almost like a blot, with odd bits going off every which way, and she frowned, wondering if she was losing her skill. But the fabric began to shimmer, like heat rising off hot blacktop. She stared as words unfolded across the cloth, as if an invisible hand was writing them. "Property of the Church of Talto, 232 Riverside Drive." A hum of excitement went through her. It was a clue, a real clue, and she'd found it herself, without any help from anyone else. 232 Riverside Drive. That was on the Upper West Side, she thought, by Riverside Park, just across the water from New Jersey. Not that long a trip at all. The Church of Talto. Clary set the steely down with a worried frown. Whatever that was, it sounded like bad news. She scooted her chair over to Luke's old desktop computer and pulled up the internet. She couldn't say she was surprised that typing in Church of Talto produced no comprehensible results. Whatever had been written there on the corner of the cloth had been in Pergadic or Thonian or some other demon language. One thing she was sure of. Whatever the Church of Talto was, it was secret, and probably bad. If it was mixed up with turning human babies into things with claws for hands, it wasn't any kind of a real religion. Clary wondered if the mother who dumped her baby near the hospital was a member of the church, and if she knew what she'd gotten herself into before her baby was born. She felt cold all over as she reached for her phone and paused with it in hand. She had been about to call her mother, but she couldn't call Jocelyn about this. Jocelyn had only just stopped crying and agreed to go out with Luke to look at rings. And while Clary thought her mother was strong enough to handle whatever the truth turned out to be, she'd doubtless get in massive trouble with the Clave for having taken her investigation this far without informing them. Luke. But Luke was with her mother. She couldn't call him. Maris, maybe. The mere idea of calling her seemed alien and intimidating. Plus, Clary knew, without quite wanting to admit to herself that it was a factor, that if she let the Clave take this over, she'd be benched. Pushed off to the sidelines of a mystery that seemed intensely personal. Not to mention that it felt like betraying her mother to the Clave. But to go running off on her own, not knowing what she'd find. Well, she had training, but not that much training. And she knew she had a tendency to act first, think later. Reluctantly, she pulled the phone toward her, hesitated a moment, and sent a quick text. 232 Riverside Drive. You need to meet me there right away. It's important. She hit the send button and sat for a moment until the screen lit up with an answering buzz. Okay. With a sigh, Clary set down the phone and went to get her weapons.
I love Maya, Jordan said. He was sitting on the futon now, having finally managed to make coffee, though he hadn't drunk any of it. He was just holding the mug in his hands, turning it around and around as he talked. You have to know that before I tell you anything else. We both came from this dismal hellhole of a town in New Jersey, and she got endless crap because her dad was black and her mom was white. She had a brother, too, who was a total psychopath. I don't know if she told you about him. Daniel. Not much, Simon said. With all that, her life was pretty hellish, but she didn't let it get her down. I met her in a music store, buying old records. Vinyl, right? We got to talking, and I realized she was basically the coolest girl for miles around. Beautiful, too, and sweet. Jordan's eyes were distant. We went out, and it was fantastic. We were totally in love. The way you are when you're 16. Then I got bit. I was in a fight one night at a club. I used to get into fights a lot. I was used to getting kicked and punched, but bitten. I thought the guy who done it was crazy, but whatever. I went to the hospital, got stitched up, forgot about it. About 3 weeks later, it started to hit. Waves of uncontrollable rage and anger. My vision would just black out and I wouldn't know what was happening. I punched my hand through my kitchen window because my drawer was stuck shut. I was crazy jealous about Maya. Convinced she was looking at other guys. Convinced. I don't even know what I thought. I just know I snapped. I hit her. I want to say I don't remember doing it, but I do. And then she broke up with me. His voice trailed off. He took a swallow of coffee. He looked sick, Simon thought. He must not have told this story much before, or ever. A couple nights later, I went to a party and she was there, dancing with another guy, kissing him,
like she wanted to prove to me it was over. It was a bad night for her to choose, not that she could have known that. It was the first full moon since I'd been bitten. His knuckles were white where he gripped the coffee. The first time I ever changed. The transformation ripped through my body and tore my bones and skin apart. I was in agony, and not just because of that. I wanted her. Wanted her to come back, wanted to explain, but all I could do was howl. I took off running through the streets, and that was when I saw her, crossing the park near her house. She was going home.
And you attacked her?
Simon said.
You bit her?
Yeah. Jordan stared blindly into the past. When I woke up the next morning, I knew what I'd done. I tried to go to her house to explain. I was halfway there when a big guy stepped into my path and stared me down. He knew who I was, knew everything about me. He explained he was a member of the Praetor Lupus, and he'd been assigned to me. He wasn't too happy that he'd gotten there too late, that I'd already bitten someone. He wouldn't let me go anywhere near her. He said I'd just make it worse. He promised the Wolf Guard would be watching over her. He told me that since I'd bitten a human already, which was strictly forbidden, the only way I'd evade punishment was to join the guard and get trained to control myself. I wouldn't have done it. I would have spit on him and taken whatever punishment they wanted to hand out. I hated myself that much. But when he explained that I'd be able to help other people like me, maybe stop what had happened to me and Maya from happening again, it was like I saw a light in the darkness, way off in the future. Like maybe it was a chance to fix what I'd done.
Okay,
Simon said slowly.
But isn't it kind of a weird coincidence that you wound up assigned to me? A guy who was dating the girl you once bit and turned into a werewolf?
No coincidence, Jordan said. Your file was one of the bunch I got handed. I picked you because Maya was mentioned in the notes. A werewolf and a vampire dating. You know, it's kind of a big deal. It was the first time I realized she'd become a werewolf after what I did.
You never checked up to find out? That seems kind of...
I tried. The Praetor didn't want me to. But I did what I could to find out what happened to her. I knew she ran away from home. But she had a crappy home life anyway, so that didn't tell me anything. And it's not like there's some national registry of werewolves where I could look her up. I just hoped she hadn't turned.
So you took my assignment because of Maya?
Jordan flushed.
I thought maybe if I met you, I could find out what happened to her, if she was okay. That's why you told me off for two-timing her?
Said Simon, thinking back.
You were being protective.
Jordan glared at him over the rim of the coffee cup.
Yeah, well, it was a jerk move. And you're the one who shoved the flyer from the band performance under her door, aren't you?
Simon shook his head.
So was messing with my love life part of the assignment, or just your personal extra touch?
I screwed her over, Jordan said. I didn't want to see her screwed over by someone else.
And it didn't occur to you that if she showed up at our performance, she'd try to rip your face off. If she hadn't been late, maybe she even would have done it while you were on stage. That would have been an exciting extra for the audience.
I didn't know, Jordan said. I didn't realize she hated me so much. I mean, I don't hate the guy who turned me. I kind of understand that he might not have been in control of himself.
Yeah, said Simon. But you never loved that guy. You never had a relationship with him. Maya loved you. She thinks you bit her and then you ditched her and never thought about her again. She's going to hate you as much as she loved you once.
Before Jordan could reply, the doorbell rang. Not the buzzer. That would have sounded if someone had been downstairs calling up, but the one that could be rung only if a visitor was standing in the hallway outside their door. The boys exchanged baffled looks.
Are you expecting someone?
Simon asked. Jordan shook his head and put the coffee cup down. Together they went into the small entryway. Jordan gestured for Simon to stand behind him before he swung open the door. There was no one there. Instead, there was a folded piece of paper on the welcome mat, weighed down by a solid-looking hunk of rock. Jordan bent to free the paper and straightened up with a frown. It's for you, he said, handing it to Simon. Puzzled, Simon unfolded the paper. Printed across the center, in childish block letters, was the message.
Simon Lewis, we have your girlfriend. You must come to 232 Riverside Drive today.
Be there before dark, or we will cut her throat.
It's a joke,
Simon said, staring numbly at the paper.
It has to be.
Without a word, Jordan grabbed Simon's arm and hauled him into the living room. Letting go of him, he rooted around for the cordless phone until he found it. Call her, he said, slapping the phone against Simon's chest. Call Meyer and make sure she's all right.